Chapman. Here was a fellow information hound, and like me, Clinton clearly enjoyed exploring ideas. I walked away impressed, yet not entirely sure what I thought. Clearly, for sheer intelligence, Bill Clinton was on a par with Richard Nixon, who, despite his obvious flaws, was the smartest president I'd met to that point. And either Clinton shared many of my views on the way the economic system was evolving and on what should be done, or he was the cleverest chameleon I'd ever encountered. I mulled all this on the airplane on my way home. After I got back to Washington, I told a friend, "I don't know that I'd have changed my vote, but I'm reassured." That feeling was reinforced a week later when Clinton announced as his senior economic team a number of familiar faces. As Treasury Secretary, he'd picked Lloyd Bentsen, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, with Roger Altman, a very smart Wall Street investment banker, as his deputy. As Budget Director, he chose Leon Panetta, a California congressman who chaired the House Budget Committee, with economist Alice Rivlin as his deputy. She was the only economist on the team, and her credentials were impressive. She'd been the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office and had been an early recipient of one of the MacArthur Foundation's Genius Grants. Just as interesting was Clinton's choice of Robert Rubin, the co-chairman of Goldman Sachs, to run a new White House Council on Economic Policy. As the New York Times explained it, Rubin was to act as the economic equivalent of a national security advisor. His job would be to elicit economic ideas from Treasury, State, the Budget Office, the CEA, and other departments, and weave them into policy options for the president. What jumped out at me was that Clinton was taking a page from John F. Kennedy's book. All of Clinton's economic policy appointees were fiscally conservative centrists, like Doug Dillon, the Republican banker whom Kennedy picked as Treasury Secretary. Choosing them made Bill Clinton seem about as far from the classic tax-and-spend liberal as you could get and still be a Democrat. Like every new administration, the Clinton White House had to scramble to pull together its first budget, due for submission to Congress by early February. The president, by all accounts, did not have an easy time dealing with the recommendations of his economic team. The full extent of the fiscal problems confronting them was only now becoming clear. In December, the Office of Management and Budget offered a revised analysis projecting that the government was headed toward a $360 billion deficit in 1997, some $50 billion higher than its previous estimate. This made it clear that to come anywhere near his goal of halving the deficit, Clinton would have to abandon or postpone other cherished plans, such as the middle-class tax cut and the investments in training and jobs. I kept tabs on the budget-making process mainly through Lloyd Bentsen. The new Treasury Secretary had first caught my attention in the 1976 primaries. Jimmy Carter ultimately beat him for the Democratic nomination, but I thought Bentsen had looked like a president and acted like one. Courtly, gray-haired, and sophisticated, he was a former World War II B-24 bomber pilot who'd served four terms in the Senate, where he had a well-earned reputation for good judgment and for quietly getting things done. Andrea and I had known Bentsen and his impressive wife, B.A., socially for some time. I was not surprised to find him a pleasure to work with, even when we disagreed. Bentsen and the others on the economic team were careful to acknowledge the Fed's boundaries. In fact, their decision not to comment publicly on monetary policy was a big break from the past and helped us and them by bolstering our independence. When he and Panetta came to brief me in mid-January on the evolving budget plan, they avoided asking for an endorsement or even an opinion. I simply indicated that I understood, and we left it at that. In fact, I thought the plan non-inflationary and testified to that effect in Congress in late January. Bentsen asked me to weigh in with the president just once, the day after I'd first testified in favor of their overall approach. I had steered clear of commenting on the details of Clinton's program. As the team crunched the numbers and the budget took shape, Clinton found himself faced with a choice that was increasingly stark. Either he could opt for a package of spending programs that would fulfill some of his campaign promises, or he could opt for a deficit-cutting plan, whose success would depend on impressing the financial markets and that would pay off chiefly in the longer term. There was no in-between. We couldn't afford both. This dilemma had opened a rift in the White House staff, some of whom privately ridiculed the deficit-cutting approach as a sellout to Wall Street. That's why Bentsen asked me to the White House, to reemphasize the urgency of budget reform. We met the president in the Oval Office on the morning of January 28th. Bob Rubin joined us. Clinton was all business, so I got straight to the point. I focused on the danger of not confronting the deficit right away, playing out for him how, in that instance, the decade was apt to unfold. Because of the end of the Cold War, I told him, defense spending will come down over the next few years, and that will mask a lot of problems. But by 1996 or 1997, the deficits will be hard for the public to ignore. You can see it in the data. And I outlined for him how the mandated outlays for Social Security and other social benefits were scheduled to increase, which would cause deficit gaps to open further. So the debt rises markedly into the 21st century, and the interest on the debt rises, threatening a spiral of rising deficits. Unless it's aborted, that could lead to a financial crisis, I said. As we finished, Clinton, unsurprisingly, looked grim. Though I hadn't put it in so many words, the hard truth was that Reagan had borrowed from Clinton, and Clinton was having to pay it back. There was no reason to feel sorry for Clinton. These very problems were what had enabled him to defeat George Bush. But I was impressed that he did not seem to be trying to fudge reality to the extent politicians ordinarily do. He was forcing himself to live in the real world on the economic outlook and monetary policy. His subsequent decision to go ahead and fight for the deficit cuts was an act of political courage. It would have been very easy to go the other way. Not many people would have been the wiser for a year or two, or even three. I took one other step to help the deficit hawks. I advised Benson on how deeply I thought the deficit would have to be cut in order to convince Wall Street and thereby bring down long-term interest rates. Not less than $130 billion a year by 1997, was his shorthand description of what I said. Actually, the advice I gave him was more complex. I sketched out a range of possibilities, with a probability attached to each, all the while carefully emphasizing that the substance and credibility of the program would be more important than the numbers. But I understood when he finally said, "You know I can't work with something this complicated." The figure he extracted made its way to the president and had a powerful effect. Within the White House, $130 billion became known as the magic number that the deficit cuts had to hit. The budget was major news when it finally appeared. "Clinton plan to remake the economy seeks to tax energy and big incomes," was the banner headline of the New York Times the morning after Clinton's speech. "Ambitious program aims at a four-year deficit cut of $500 billion. USA Today declared, "A battle launched," and described Clinton's proposals as "a five-year package of pain." The media coverage focused mainly on whom the cuts would hit. Every constituency except poor households, the plan put burdens on the rich, the middle class, retirees, and business. Interestingly, the public reaction was initially favorable. Polls showed Americans unexpectedly receptive to the idea of making a sacrifice to put the nation's house in order. Most new presidents get a honeymoon from Congress, but Clinton got a trench war. Despite the budget plan's initial popularity, a majority of Congresspeople hated it, not surprisingly, since it aimed at abstract, distant goals and offered no new highway projects, weapons programs, or other lucrative goodies to bring home to constituents. I think Clinton was jolted by the degree of resistance. Republicans rejected the budget outright, and many Democrats rebelled, and the debates dragged on well into the spring. Even though Democrats held a 258-177 majority in the House, there was serious question whether the budget would pass, and its prospects in the Senate looked even worse. The conflict extended to within the White House, where key people were still pushing for an agenda less compatible with Wall Street. One was Clinton advisor James Carville, who famously wisecracked, "I used to think if there was reincarnation, I wanted to come back as the president or the pope or a 400 baseball hitter, but now I want to come back as the bond market. You can intimidate everybody." The discord, which was widely reported in the media, made Clinton look weak, and his initial popularity melted away. By late spring, his approval rating sank to an abysmal 28%. The president was in a funk when I saw him again on June 9th. The House had finally passed his budget 2 weeks earlier, by a single vote, and the fight had only begun in the Senate. I'd gotten a call from David Gergen, Clinton's counselor. "He's distressed," he said, and asked if I could come buck the president up. I'd known Gergen for 20 years, as an advisor to Nixon, Ford, and Reagan. Clinton had recruited him partly because he was a balanced, non-neurotic Washington pro, and partly because he was Republican, The president was hoping to solidify his image as a centrist. When I went to the Oval Office that morning, you could see that people were under strain. Word had it that they'd been working pretty much around the clock, even Benson, who was 72. Andrea confirmed this. She was now NBC's chief White House correspondent. They'd been going back and forth with Congress, trying to get the numbers to work, and doubtless felt as if they were up against an impossible problem. The president himself seemed subdued. It wasn't hard to imagine why. He was spending his political capital, yet the budget for which he'd sacrificed so much was in peril. I encouraged him as best I could. I told him that his plan was our best chance in 40 years to get stable long-term growth. I tried to get him to see that the strategy was on track, was working. Long-term rates were already trending down, I showed him. The very fact that he'd come out and recognized that the deficit had to be addressed was a very important plus. But I also warned that it wouldn't be easy. Indeed, Clinton had to fight, arm twist, and horse trade for another 2 months to push his budget through the Senate. As in the House, it passed by a single vote, this time a tiebreaker by Vice President Gore. Clinton impressed me again that fall by fighting for the ratification of NAFTA. The treaty, negotiated under President Bush, was designed primarily to phase out tariffs and other trade barriers between Mexico and the United States, though it also included Canada. Labor unions hated it, and so did most Democrats, as well as some conservatives. Few Congress watchers thought it had a prayer. But Clinton argued, in effect, that you cannot stop the world from turning. Like it or not, America was increasingly part of the international economy, and NAFTA embodied the belief that trade and competition create prosperity, and you need free markets to do that. He and the White House staff went all out, and after a 2-month struggle, they got the treaty approved. All this convinced me that our new president was a risk-taker who was not content with the status quo. Again, he'd shown a preference for dealing in facts. And on free trade, the fact was this. The distinction between domestic competition and cross-border competition has no economic meaning. If you're in a Dubuque, Iowa plant, it makes no difference whether you're competing with someone in Santa Fe or across the border. With the geopolitical pressure of the Cold War now removed, the United States had a historic opportunity to knit the international economy more closely together. Clinton was often criticized for inconsistency and for a tendency to take all sides in a debate, but that was never true about his economic policy. A consistent, disciplined focus on long-term economic growth became a hallmark of his presidency. The Fed was having its own difficulties with Congress that year, and for some of the same reasons. Our fiercest critic was Congressman Henry B. Gonzalez of Texas, the chairman of the House Banking Committee. A hot-tempered populist from San Antonio, Gonzalez was famous for socking in the eye a constituent at a restaurant who called him a communist. At various times in Congress, Gonzalez had called for the impeachment of Reagan, Bush, and Paul Volcker. He was deeply distrustful of what he labeled the tremendous power of the Fed. I think he simply assumed that the board was a cabal of Republican appointees who were running monetary policy more for the benefit of Wall Street than the working man. In the fall of 1993, Gonzalez really turned up the heat. The Fed has always rubbed Congress the wrong way, and it probably always will, even though Congress created it. There's inherent conflict between the Fed's statutory long-term focus and the short-term needs of most politicians with constituents to please. This friction often surfaced in oversight hearings. The Fed was obligated to render a biannual report on its monetary policy decisions and the economic outlook. At times, these hearings sparked substantive discussions of major issues, but just as often they were a theater in which I was a prop. The audience was the voters back home. During the Bush administration, Senate Banking Committee Chairman Alphonse D'Amato of New York rarely missed a chance to bash the Fed. "People are going to starve out there, and you are going to be worried about inflation," he'd tell me. That sort of remark I always let slide. But when he or anyone would assert that interest rates were too high, I would answer and explain why we'd done what we'd done. I took care, naturally, to couch any discussion of possible future moves in Fed speak to keep from roiling the markets. Gonzalez went on a crusade to make the Fed more accountable, zeroing in on what he saw as our excessive secrecy. He wanted the Federal Open Market Committee, in particular, to conduct its affairs in public, and even open its deliberations to live TV coverage. At one point, he dragged 18 members of the FOMC to Capitol Hill to testify under oath and denounced the long-standing FOMC practice of never publicly announcing policy moves or rate changes. The only public record of each meeting was a brief set of minutes published 6 weeks after the fact, for the financial markets a virtual eternity. As a consequence, any signals coming from the Fed's open market operations or public statements by Fed officials were subject to avid scrutiny by Wall Street. For its part, the Federal Reserve, in the interest of economic stability, had long sought to foster highly liquid debt markets through the use of what we called constructive ambiguity. The idea was that markets uncertain as to the direction of interest rates would create a desired large buffer of both bids and offers. By the early 1990s, however, markets were becoming sufficiently broad and liquid without this support from the Fed. Moreover, the advantage of market participants being able to anticipate the Federal Reserve's future moves was seen as stabilizing the debt markets. We had begun a path toward greater transparency in our deliberations and operations, but far short of the policy Henry Gonzalez would have liked us to pursue. I was opposed to the idea of throwing these meetings open. The FOMC was our primary decision-making body. If its discussions were made public, with the details of who said what to whom, the meetings would become a series of bland, written presentations. The advantages to policy formulation of unfettered debate would be lost. My effort to convey this argument in the hearings, however, did not go well. As Gonzalez bored in on the question of what records we kept, I found myself in an extremely awkward position. In 1976, during the Ford administration, Arthur Burns had directed the staff to audiotape FOMC meetings to assist in the writing of the minutes. This practice continued, and I knew about it, but I'd always assumed the tapes were erased once the minutes were done. In preparing for the Banking Committee testimony, I learned that this wasn't exactly the case. Although the tapes indeed were routinely erased, the staff kept copies of the complete unedited transcripts in a locked file cabinet down the hall from my office. When I revealed the transcript's existence, Gonzalez pounced. Now more convinced than ever that we were conspiring to hide embarrassing secrets, he threatened to subpoena the records. Gonzalez was especially suspicious of two conference calls the FOMC had conducted in preparing for the hearings. We did not want to release these tapes, for fear of creating a precedent. After a bit of negotiation, we agreed to let lawyers for the committee, one Democrat and one Republican, come to the Fed and listen. The Watergate tapes had been a lot more exciting, they quickly discovered. After listening patiently for the better part of 2 hours to the FOMC's deliberations, the Democrat left without a word, and the Republican remarked that the tape ought to be used to teach students in high school civics classes how government meetings should work. Congressman Gonzalez was quoted in the New York Times, November 16, 1993, complaining that the tapes included disparaging remarks about one distinguished member of the House Banking Committee and Banking Committee members in general. All the same, my colleagues were upset, mainly with Gonzalez, but they probably weren't too happy with me either. For one thing, most of them hadn't even known our meetings were being taped, and the thought that any remarks they now made might be published immediately if Gonzalez got his way put a chill in the air. The next time the FOMC met, on November 16th, people were clearly less willing to kick around ideas. "You could notice a difference, and not for the better," a governor told a Washington Post reporter. After thorough discussion, the board decided to resist, in court if necessary, any subpoena or demand that might hamper the effectiveness of the institution. But the controversy also accelerated our recent deliberations about transparency. Eventually, we decided that the FOMC would announce its moves immediately after each meeting, and that the complete transcript would be published after a 5-year lag. People joked that this was the Fed equivalent of glasnost. We did these things knowing that published transcripts made our meetings longer and a little less creative. In the event, the sky did not fall. Not only did the changes make the process more transparent, but they also gave us new ways to communicate with the markets. I was grateful that President Clinton kept his distance from this whole teapot tempest. "Does anybody in his right mind think we would do anything to change the independence of the Fed?" was all he would say afterward, adding, "I have no criticism of the Federal Reserve since I've been president." In the midst of such Washington melodramas, it was sometimes easy to forget that there was a real world out there in which real things were happening. That summer, flooding from the Mississippi and Missouri rivers paralyzed 9 Midwestern states. NASA astronauts went into orbit to repair the Hubble Space Telescope. There was a failed coup against Boris Yeltsin, and Nelson Mandela won the Nobel Peace Prize. There were disconcerting outbreaks of violence in the United States. The bombing of the World Trade Center, the siege at Waco, and the killing and maiming of scientists and professors by the Unabomber. In corporate America, something called business process re-engineering became the latest management fad, and Lou Gerstner began an effort to turn around IBM. Most important from the Fed's standpoint, the economy seemed finally to have shaken off its early 1990s woes. Business investment, housing, and consumer spending all rose sharply, and unemployment fell. By the end of 1993, not only had real GDP grown 8.5% since the 1991 recession, but it was expanding at a 5.5% annual rate. All of which led the Fed to decide that it was time to tighten. On February 4, 1994, the FOMC voted to hike the Fed funds interest rate by 0.25 percentage point to 3.25%. This was the first rate hike in 5 years, and we imposed it for 2 reasons. First, the post-1980s credit crunch had finally ended. Consumers were getting the mortgages they needed, and businesses were getting loans. For many months, while credit was tight, we'd kept the Fed funds rate exceptionally low, at 3%. In fact, if you allowed for inflation, which was also nearly at a 3% annual rate, the rate on Fed funds was next to nothing in real terms. Now that the financial system had recovered, it was time to end this overly accommodative stance, as we called it. The second reason was the business cycle itself. The economy was in a growth phase, but we wanted the inevitable downturn, when it came, to be less of a roller coaster ride, a moderate slowing instead of a sickening plunge into recession. The Fed had long tried to get ahead of the curve by tightening rates at the first sign of inflation, before the economy had a chance to seriously overheat. But raising rates in this way had never averted a recession. This time, we opted to take advantage of the relative economic tranquility to try a more radical approach, moving gently and preemptively before inflation even appeared. It was a matter of psychology, I explained to the Congress that February. Based on what we'd learned in recent years about inflation expectations, I said, "If the Federal Reserve waits until actual inflation worsens before taking countermeasures, it would have waited too long. Modest corrective steps would no longer be enough to contain the emerging economic imbalances. Instead, more wrenching measures would be needed, with unavoidable adverse side effects on near-term economic activity." Because so much time had passed since our last rate increase, I worried that the news would rattle the markets. So, with the FOMC's consent, I hinted strongly in advance that a policy shift was imminent. "Short-term interest rates are abnormally low," I told Congress in late January. "At some point, absent an unexpected and prolonged weakening of economic activity, we will need to move them." This may sound overly subtle to the reader, but on the scale of Fed public statements in advance of a policy move, it was like banging a pot. I also visited the White House to give the President and his advisors a heads up. "We haven't made a final decision," I told them. "But the choices are, we sit and wait and then likely we'll have to raise rates more. Or we could take some small increases now." Clinton responded, "Obviously I would prefer low rates," but he said he understood. The rest of the world, by contrast, seemed to turn a deaf ear. The markets did nothing to discount a rate hike. Typically, in advance of an expected increase, short-term interest rates would edge up and stocks would edge down. So when we actually made the move, it was a jolt. In keeping with our new openness, we decided at the February 4th FOMC meeting to announce the rate hike as soon as we adjourned. By day's end, the Dow Jones Industrial Average had plunged 96 points, almost 2.5%. Some politicians reacted vehemently. Senator Paul Sarbanes of Maryland, a frequent Fed critic, compared us to a bomber coming along and striking a farmhouse because you think that the villain inflation is inside, when in fact what's inside is a happy family appreciating the restoration of economic growth. To me, such reactions merely showed how attached Americans were becoming to low, stable interest rates. Behind the closed doors of the Fed, several of the bank presidents had pushed for twice as large an increase. Fearing a panicky market reaction to too sharp a rise, I had urged my colleagues to keep this initial move small. We continued to apply the brakes throughout 1994, until by year-end the Fed funds rate stood at 5.5%. Even so, the economy had a very good year. It grew a robust 4%, it added 3.5 million new jobs, productivity increased, and business profits rose. Equally important, inflation did not increase at all. For the first time since the 1960s, it had been under a 3% annual rate for 3 years running. Low to stable prices were becoming a reality and an expectation. So much so that in late 1994, when I spoke to the Business Council, an association made up of the heads of major companies, a few of the CEOs were complaining that it was hard to make price increases stick. I was unsympathetic. "What do you mean you're having problems?" I asked. "Profit margins are going up. Stop complaining." For decades, analysts had wondered whether the dynamics of the business cycle ruled out the possibility of a soft landing for the economy, a cyclical slowdown without the job losses and uncertainty of a recession. The term soft landing actually came from the 1970s space race, when the United States and the Soviet Union were competing to land unmanned probes on Venus and Mars. Some of those spacecraft made successful soft landings, but the economy never had. In fact, the expression wasn't even used at the Fed. But in 1995, a soft landing was exactly what took place. Economic growth slowed throughout the year to an annualized rate of less than 1% in the fourth quarter, when our metaphoric spacecraft gently touched down. In 1996, the economy picked back up again. By November, when President Clinton would win re-election, activity was expanding at a solid 4% rate. The media celebrated a soft landing long before I was willing to. Even in December 1996, I was still cautioning colleagues, "We haven't fully completed the process. 6 months from now, we could run into a recession." But in hindsight, the soft landing of 1995 was one of the Fed's proudest accomplishments during my tenure. All of this lay hidden in the future, of course, as the FOMC was tightening rates. Knowing when to start tightening, and by how much, and most important, when to stop, was a fascinating and sometimes nerve-wracking intellectual challenge, especially because no one had tried it this way before. It didn't feel like, "Oh, let's execute a soft landing." It felt more like, "Let's jump out of this 60-story building and try to land on our feet." The toughest call for some committee members was the rate hike that proved to be the last, a 0.5% increase on February 1, 1995. "I fear that if we act today, our move may be the one we turn out to regret," said Janet Yellen, a governor who would later become chairman of Clinton's Council of Economic Advisers. She was the most vocal advocate for shifting to a stance of wait and see. The increase, which we went on to adopt unanimously that day, brought the Fed funds rate all the way to 6%, double where it had stood when we'd started less than a year before. Everyone on the FOMC knew the risks. Had we turned the screw one time too many, or not enough? We were groping through a fog. The FOMC has always recognized that in a tightening cycle, if we stop too soon, inflationary pressures will resurge and make it very difficult to contain them again. We therefore always tend to take out the insurance of an additional Fed funds increase, fully expecting that it may not be necessary. Ending the course of monetary antibiotics too soon risks the reemergence of the infection of inflation. For President Clinton, meanwhile, 1994 had been a miserable year. It was marked by the collapse of his health care initiative, followed by the stunning loss of both the House and the Senate in the midterm elections. The Republicans won on the basis of Newt Gingrich's and Dick Armey's Contract with America, an anti-big government plan that promised tax cuts, welfare reform, and a balanced budget. Within weeks, Clinton was put to the test again. In late December, Mexico revealed that it was on the brink of financial collapse. Its problem was billions of dollars of short-term debt borrowed when the economy was thriving. Lately, that growth had slowed, and as the economy weakened, the peso had to be devalued, making the borrowed dollars increasingly expensive to repay. By the time Mexico's leaders asked for help, government finances were in a downward spiral, with $25 billion coming due in less than a year and only $6 billion in dollar reserves, which were dwindling fast. None of us had forgotten the Latin American debt crisis of 1982, when an $80 billion default by Mexico had triggered a cascade of emergency refinancings in Brazil, Venezuela, Argentina, and other countries. That episode nearly toppled several giant U.S. banks and had set back economic development in Latin America by a decade. The crisis of late 1994 was smaller, yet the risk was hard to overstate. It, too, could spread to other nations, and because of the growing integration of world financial markets and trade, it threatened not just Latin America, but other parts of the developing world. What's more, as NAFTA demonstrated, the United States and Mexico were increasingly interdependent. If Mexico's economy were to collapse, the flow of immigrants to the United States would redouble, and the economy of the Southwest would be clobbered. The crisis hit just as Andrea and I were leaving on a post-Christmas getaway to New York. I'd booked us into the Stanhope, an elegant Fifth Avenue hotel directly across from Central Park and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. We'd been looking forward to a few days of concerts, shopping, and just wandering around in the relative anonymity of the city where we'd met. 10 years had passed since the snowy evening of our first date for dinner at Le Perigot on East 52nd Street. And while this wasn't a formal anniversary, we always liked to make it back to the city and the site of that first date between Christmas and New Year's. As soon as we arrived, though, the phone began to ring. It was my office at the Fed. Bob Rubin, now the Treasury Secretary designee, urgently needed to talk about the peso. Bob was slated to take over officially from Lloyd Benson, who was retiring, right after New Year's Day, but for all intents and purposes he was already on the job. I'm sure he'd been hoping for an easier transition than this. Instead, he was facing a baptism by fire. Andrea realized instantly what the phone call meant. On any foreign financial crisis affecting the United States, the Treasury Department takes the lead, but the Fed always gets involved. "So much for romance," she sighed. She understood me and my job too well after all these years. I was grateful for her generosity and patience. So, as the Mexico crisis unfolded, she went shopping and visited friends, and I spent the entire stay in our hotel room on the phone. In the following weeks, the administration huddled with Mexican officials, the International Monetary Fund, and other institutions. The IMF was prepared to offer Mexico what help it could, but it lacked the funds to make a decisive difference. Behind the scenes, I argued, as did Bob Rubin and his top deputy Larry Summers and others, that U.S. intervention should be massive and fast. To forestall a collapse, Mexico needed sufficient funding to persuade investors not to dump pesos or demand immediate repayment of their loans. This was based on the same principle of market psychology as piling currency in a bank's window to stop a run on the bank, something U.S. banks used to do during crises in the 19th century. In Congress, remarkably, leaders from both parties were in accord. Potential chaos in a nation of 80 million people with whom we shared a 2,000-mile border was too serious to ignore. On January 15th, President Clinton, Newt Gingrich, the new House Speaker, and Bob Dole, the new Senate Majority Leader, jointly put forward a $40 billion package of loan guarantees for congressional approval. As dramatic as that gesture was, within days it became clear that politically the bailout didn't have a prayer. Americans have always resisted the idea that a foreign country's money problems can have major consequences for the United States. Mexico's crisis, coming so soon after NAFTA, aggravated this isolationist impulse. Everyone who'd fought NAFTA, labor, consumer, and environmental activists, and the Republican right, rose up again to oppose the rescue. Gene Sperling, one of Clinton's top economic advisors, summed up the political dilemma. How do you deal with a problem that to the public doesn't seem important, that seems like giving money away, that seems like bailing out people who made dumb investments? When the $40 billion proposal was rolled out, Newt Gingrich asked me if I would call Rush Limbaugh and explain why it was in America's best interest to intervene. "I don't know Rush Limbaugh," I said. "Do you really think calling him will make a difference?" "He'll listen to you," Gingrich told me. The ultra-combative radio host was a force among conservatives. Some of the freshman congressmen had actually taken to calling themselves the Dittohead Caucus, using the favorite nickname of fans of his show. Needless to say, Limbaugh was having a field day trashing the thought of giving Mexico a hand. I was still dubious, but it impressed me that the new House Speaker was willing to support a Democratic president on a clearly unpopular issue. So, reluctantly, I picked up the phone. Limbaugh seemed even less comfortable than I. He listened politely as I laid out my arguments and thanked me for taking the time. This surprised me. I'd expected Rush Limbaugh to be more confrontational. The situation couldn't wait for Congress to come around. In late January, with Mexico teetering on the brink, the administration took matters into its own hands. Bob Rubin turned to a solution that had been proposed and dismissed early on, tapping an emergency treasury fund that had been created under FDR to protect the value of the dollar. Rubin felt great trepidation about risking tens of billions of taxpayers' dollars, and even though the congressional leaders promised to acquiesce, there was the risk of appearing to circumvent the will of the people. A major poll showed voters opposed helping Mexico by a stunning margin of 79% to 18%. I pitched in to help work out the details of the plan. Rubin and Summers presented it to President Clinton on the night of January 31st. The surprise was still in Bob's voice when he phoned afterward to report the result. Clinton had said simply, "Look, this is something we have to do," Rubin told me, adding, "He didn't hesitate at all." That decision broke the logjam. The International Monetary Fund and other international bodies more than matched some $20 billion of guarantees from the Treasury to offer Mexico a package totaling, with all its components, $50 billion, mostly in the form of short-term loans. These weren't giveaways, as opponents had claimed. In fact, the terms were so stiff that Mexico ended up using only a fraction of the credit. The minute that confidence in the peso was restored, it paid the money back. The United States actually profited $500 million on the deal. It was a sweet victory for the new Treasury Secretary and his team, and the experience formed a lasting bond between Rubin, Summers, and me. In the countless hours we spent analyzing the issues, brainstorming and testing ideas, meeting with our foreign counterparts, and testifying before Congress, we became economic foxhole buddies. I felt a mutual trust with Rubin that only deepened as time passed. It would never enter my mind that he would do something contrary to what he said he would do without informing me in advance. I hope it was the same way with him. Even though we came from opposing parties, there was a sense that we were working for the same firm. We agreed on many basic issues, and neither of us liked confrontation for confrontation's sake, which made it easy to communicate and spark off each other's ideas. Summers, of course, had started as the economics wunderkind. The son of Ph.D. economists and the nephew of two Nobel laureates in economics, he was one of the youngest professors ever to get tenure at Harvard. Before joining the administration, he'd been chief economist of the World Bank. He was an expert in public finance, development economics, and other fields. What I liked best was that he was a technician and a conceptualizer like me, with a passion for grounding theory in empirical fact. He was also steeped in economic history, which he used as a reality check. He worried, for example, that the president was getting carried away with the promise of information technology, as though the United States had never gone through periods of rapid technological progress before. "Too yippity about productivity," was how Larry once described Clinton's techno-enthusiasm. I disagreed, and we had debates about the Internet's potential, with Bob taking it all in. Larry could be shrewd, too. It was his idea to put such a high interest rate on the Mexico loans that the Mexicans felt compelled to pay us back early. Rubin and Summers and I met confidentially over breakfast each week for the next 4.5 years, and we would phone and drop by one another's offices frequently in between. Larry and I continued the practice after Bob returned to Wall Street in mid-1999, and Larry became Treasury Secretary. We'd gather at 8:30 a.m. in Bob's office or mine, have breakfast brought in, and then sit for an hour or two, pooling information, crunching numbers, strategizing, and brewing ideas. I always came out of these breakfasts smarter than when I arrived. They were the best forum I could imagine for puzzling out the so-called new economy. The dual forces of information technology and globalization were beginning to take hold, and as President Clinton later put it, the rule books were out of date. Democrats joyfully labeled the constellation of economic policies Rubinomics. Looking back in 2003, a New York Times reviewer of Bob's memoir called Rubinomics the essence of the Clinton presidency. He defined it as soaring prices for stocks, real estate, and other assets, low inflation, declining unemployment, increasing productivity, a strong dollar, low tariffs, the willingness to serve as global crisis manager, and most of all, a huge projected federal budget surplus. I wish I could say that it was all the result of conscious, effective policy coming out of our weekly breakfasts. Some of it surely was. But mostly, it reflected the onset of a new phase of globalization and the economic fallout from the demise of the Soviet Union, issues I will address in later chapters. I saw President Clinton only infrequently. Because Bob and I worked together so well, there was rarely any need for me to attend an economic policy meeting in the Oval Office, except in moments of crisis, such as when a budget standoff between Clinton and Congress forced a shutdown of the government in 1995. I did eventually hear that the president had been sore at me and the Fed for much of 1994, while we were hiking interest rates. "I thought the economy had not picked up enough to warrant it," he explained to me years later. But he never challenged the Fed in public. And by mid-1995, Clinton and I had settled into an easy, impromptu relationship. At a White House dinner or reception, he'd pull me aside to see what was on my mind or to try out an idea. I didn't share his baby boom upbringing or his love of rock and roll. Probably he found me dry, not the kind of buddy he liked to smoke cigars and watch football with. But we both read books and were curious and thoughtful about the world, and we got along. Clinton publicly called us the economic odd couple. I never ceased to be surprised by his fascination with economic detail, the effect of Canadian lumber on housing prices and inflation, the trend toward just-in-time manufacturing. He had an eye for the big picture, too, like the historic connection between income inequality and economic change. He believed dot-com millionaires were an inevitable byproduct of progress. "Whenever you shift to a new economic paradigm, there's more inequality," he'd say. "There was more when we moved from farm to factory. Vast fortunes were made by those who financed the Industrial Revolution and those who built the railroads. Now we were shifting into the digital age, so we had dot-com millionaires. Change was a good thing," Clinton said, but he wanted ways to get more of that new wealth into the hands of the middle class. Politics being what they are, I never thought Clinton would reappoint me as chairman when my term ended in March 1996. He was a Democrat, and no doubt he would want one of his own. But by the end of 1995, my prospects had changed. American business was doing exceptionally well. Profits at large companies were up 18%, and the stock market had had its best growth in 20 years. Fiscal and monetary policy were both working, with the 1996 deficit projected to shrink to less than $110 billion, and inflation still below 3%. GDP growth was starting to revive without a recession. The relationship between the Fed and the Treasury had never been better. As New Year's came and went, the press began speculating that the president might ask me to stay. In January, Bob Rubin and I went to a G7 meeting in Paris. During a pause in the proceedings, we wandered off to the side. I could tell that Bob had something on his mind. I can still picture the scene. We were standing in front of a floor-to-ceiling plate-glass window with a panoramic view of the city. "You'll be getting a call from the president when we get back to Washington," he said. He didn't come right out and tell me, but I knew from his body language that the news must be good. President Clinton set a little challenge for me and for the two Fed officials he appointed at the same time, Alice Rivlin, who was to be Fed vice chairman, and Lawrence Meyer, a highly regarded economics forecaster who would become a Fed governor. "There is now a debate, a serious debate in this country, about whether there is a maximum growth rate we can have over any period of years without inflation," the president told reporters. It wasn't hard to read between the lines. With the economy entering its sixth year of expansion and with the soft landing looking real, he was asking for faster growth, higher wages, and new jobs. He wanted to see what this rocket could do. Chapter 8. Irrational exuberance. August 9, 1995, will go down in history as the day the dot-com boom was born. What set it off was the initial public offering of Netscape, a tiny, two-year-old software maker in Silicon Valley that had almost no revenues and not a penny of profits. Netscape was actually giving most of its products away. Yet its browser software had fueled an explosion in Internet use, helping turn what had started as a U.S. government-funded online sandbox for scientists and engineers into the digital thoroughfare for the world. The day Netscape stock began to trade, it rocketed from $28 a share to $71, astonishing investors from Silicon Valley to Wall Street. The internet gold rush was on. More and more startups went public to fantastic valuations. Netscape stock continued to climb. By November, the company had a higher market capitalization than Delta Airlines, and Netscape chairman Jim Clark became the first internet billionaire. High-tech excitement brought extra sizzle that year to what was already a hot market for stocks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average broke 4,000, then 5,000, ending 1995 up by well over 30%. The technology-heavy NASDAQ, where the new stocks were listed, finished even better, with a gain of more than 40% in its composite index. And the market growth roared unabated into 1996. We generally did not talk about the stock market very much at the Fed. In a typical FOMC meeting, in fact, the word stock was used more often in reference to capital stock, machine tools, rail cars, and lately computers and telecom gear, than in reference to equity shares. As far as the tech boom was concerned, our focus was more on the people who make the chips, write the software, build the networks, and integrate information technology into factories and offices and entertainment. Yet we were all aware of a wealth effect. Investors, feeling flush because of gains in their portfolios, borrowed more and spent more freely on houses and cars and consumer goods. More important, I thought, was the impact of rising equity values on business outlays on plant and equipment. Ever since I delivered a paper entitled Stock Prices and Capital Evaluation at an obscure session of the annual meeting of the American Statistical Association in December 1959, I had been intrigued by the impact of stock prices on capital investment and hence on the level of economic activity. This paper, which appeared in the American Statistical Association's Proceedings of the Business and Economic Statistics Section, 1959, later formed part of my doctoral thesis. I showed that the ratio of stock prices to the price of newly produced plant and equipment correlated with new orders for machinery. The reasoning was clear to real estate developers, who work by a similar principle. If the market value of office buildings in a certain location exceeds the cost of building one from scratch, new buildings will sprout up. If, on the other hand, the market values fall below the cost of constructing a building, new construction will stop. It appeared to me that the correlation between stock prices and new machinery orders was telling a similar story. When corporate management saw higher market values on capital equipment than the cost of purchase, such spending would rise, and the reverse was also true. I was disappointed when that simple ratio failed to work as well in forecasting during the 1960s as it had in earlier years. But that was, and is, a common complaint of econometricians. Today's version of that relationship is converted to its equivalent implicit rates of return on newly contemplated capital investment. It still doesn't work as well in forecasting as I always thought it should, but the notion was a backdrop to my thoughts at a December 1995 FOMC meeting. Mike Prell, the Fed's top domestic economist, argued that the wealth effect might boost consumer expenditures by $50 billion in the coming year, causing GDP growth to accelerate. Governor Larry Lindsey, who would go on to become President George W. Bush's chief economic advisor, thought this was implausible. Most stocks were held in pension funds and 401ks, he argued, making it hard for consumers to lay hands on their gains. And most individuals who owned large stock portfolios were already very well off, not the types to indulge automatically in spending sprees. I wasn't sure I agreed with him on that point. But the issue was new. None of us knew what to expect. The morning's discussion also revealed how clueless we were about the growing strength of the bull market. Janet Yellen predicted that any effect of the stock boom would surely dissipate soon. It will be gone by the end of 1996, she said. I was concerned that the stock boom could set the stage for a crash. The real danger is that we are at the edge of a bond and stock bubble, I said. Yet the market did not seem as superheated as it had seemed in 1987. I speculated that we probably were close to at least some temporary peak in stock prices, if for no other reason than that markets do not go straight up indefinitely. That statement did not turn out to be my most prescient. But then, the stock market wasn't my main concern that day. I had a different agenda. I was determined to start people thinking about the big picture of technological change. In studying what was going on in the economy, I'd become persuaded that we were on the verge of a historic shift. The soaring stock prices were just a sign of it. The meeting was scheduled to wrap up with a proposal to continue easing the Fed funds rate and a vote. But before we got to that, I told the committee, I wanted to step back. For months, I reminded them, we'd been seeing evidence of the economic impacts of accelerating technological change. I told them, I want to raise a broad hypothesis about where the economy is going over the longer term and what the underlying forces are. My idea was that as the world absorbed information technology and learned to put it to work, we had entered what would prove to be a protracted period of lower inflation, lower interest rates, increased productivity, and full employment. I've been looking at business cycles since the late 1940s, I said. There has been nothing like this. The depth and persistence of such technological changes, I noted, appear only once every 50 or 100 years. To suggest the global scale of the change, I alluded to a new phenomenon. Inflation seemed to be ebbing all over the world. My point was that monetary policy might now be operating at the edge of knowledge where, at least for a while, time-honored rules of thumb might not apply. This was all pretty speculative, especially for a working session of the FOMC. No one at the table said much in response, though a few of the bank presidents mildly agreed. Most committee members seemed relieved to return to the familiar ground of deciding whether to lower the Fed funds rate by 0.25%. We voted to do so. But before we did, one of our most thoughtful members couldn't resist teasing me. I hope you will allow me to agree with the reasons you've given for lowering the rate, he said, without signing on to your Brave New World scenario, which I am not quite ready to do. Actually, that was fine. I didn't expect the committee to agree with me, yet. Nor was I asking them to do anything. Just ponder. The fast-paced high-tech boom is what finally gave broad currency to Schumpeter's idea of creative destruction. It became a dot-com buzz phrase. Indeed, once you accelerate to internet speed, creative destruction is hard to overlook. In Silicon Valley, companies were continually remaking themselves, and new businesses were constantly flaring up and flaming out. The reigning powers of technology, giants like AT&T, Hewlett-Packard, and IBM, had to scramble to catch up with the trend, and not all succeeded. Bill Gates, the world's biggest billionaire, issued an all-points bulletin to Microsoft employees comparing the rise of the Internet to the advent of the PC, upon which, of course, the company's great success was based. The memo was entitled, "The Internet Tidal Wave." They had better pay attention to this latest upheaval, he warned. Adapt to it or die. Though it wasn't obvious, the revolution in information technology had been 40 years in the making. It began after World War II with the development of the transistor, which provoked a surge of innovation. The computer, satellites, the microprocessor, and the joining of laser and fiber optic technologies for communications all helped set the stage for the Internet's seemingly sudden and rapid emergence. Business now had an enormous capacity to gather and disseminate information. This accelerated the creative destruction process as capital shifted from stagnant or mediocre companies and industries to those at the cutting edge. Silicon Valley venture capital firms with names like Kleiner Perkins and Sequoia and investment banks like Hambrecht and Quist suddenly achieved great wealth and prominence by facilitating this money shift. But the financing actually involved and continues to involve all of Wall Street. To take a more recent example, compare Google and General Motors. In November 2005, GM announced plans to terminate up to 30,000 employees and close 12 plants by 2008. If you looked at the company's flows of cash, you could see GM was directing billions of dollars it historically might have used to create products or build factories into funds to cover future pensions and health benefits for workers and retirees. These funds, in turn, were investing the capital where returns were most promising, in areas like high tech. At the same time, Google, of course, was growing at a tremendous rate. The company's capital expenditures increased nearly threefold in 2005 to more than $800 million. And in the expectation that the growth would continue, investors bid up the total market value of Google's stock to 11 times that of GM's. In fact, the General Motors Pension Fund owned Google shares, a textbook example of capital shifting as a result of creative destruction. Why should information technology have such a vast transforming effect? Much of corporate activity is directed at reducing uncertainty. For most of the 20th century, corporate leaders lacked timely knowledge of customers' needs. This has always been costly to the bottom line. Decisions were made based on information that was days or even weeks old. Most companies hedged. They maintained extra inventory and backup teams of employees ready to respond to the unanticipated and the misjudged. This insurance usually worked, but its price was always high. Standby inventories and workers are all costs, and standby work hours produce no output. They produce no revenue or added productivity. The real-time information supplied by the newer technologies has markedly reduced the uncertainties associated with day-to-day business. Real-time communication between the retail checkout counter and the factory floor, and between shippers and truckers hauling freight, has led to shorter delivery times and fewer hours of work required to provide everything from books to factory gear, from stock quotes to software. Information technology has released much of the extra inventory and the ranks of backup workers to productive and profitable uses. Also new for the consumer was the convenience of being able to call up information online, track packages in shipment, and order virtually anything for delivery overnight. Overall, the tech boom also had a major positive effect on employment. Many more jobs were being created than were being lost. Indeed, our unemployment rates fell from over 6% in 1994 to less than 4% in 2000, and in the process, the economy spawned 16 million new jobs. Yet, much has happened with the 19th-century telegraph operators I'd idealized in my youth. Technology began in a major way to upend white-collar occupations. Suddenly, millions of Americans found themselves exposed to the dark side of creative destruction. Secretarial and clerical functions got absorbed into computer software, as did drafting jobs in architecture and in automotive and industrial design. Job insecurity, historically a problem mainly of blue-collar workers, became an issue starting in the 1990s for more highly educated, affluent people. This came through dramatically in survey data. In 1991, at the bottom of the business cycle, a survey of employees of large corporations showed 25% were afraid of being laid off. In 1995 and 1996, despite a sharp intervening decline in the unemployment rate, 46% were afraid. That trend, of course, put job worries squarely in the public eye. Important, but not as obvious, was the increase in job mobility. Today, Americans change employers on a truly stupendous scale. Out of nearly 150 million people employed in the workforce, 1 million leave their jobs each week. Some 600,000 quit voluntarily, while roughly 400,000 get laid off, often when their companies are acquired or downsized. At the same time, 1 million workers are hired or return from layoffs each week as new industries expand and new companies come on stream. The swifter the spread of technological innovation and the broader its impact, the more we economists had to scramble to figure out which fundamentals had changed and which hadn't. Experts in the mid-1990s spent endless hours debating the so-called natural level of unemployment, for instance, technically the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, or NARU for short. This is a neo-Keynesian concept that was used in the early 1990s to argue that if unemployment fell below 6.5%, then workers' wage demands would accelerate, causing inflation to heat up. So as unemployment trended down to 6% in 1994, 5.6% in 1995, on its way to 4% and lower, many economists contended that the Fed should put the brakes on growth. I argued against this way of thinking within the Fed and in public testimony. The natural rate, while unambiguous in a model and useful for historical analyses, has always proved elusive when estimated in real time. The number was continually revised and did not offer a stable platform for inflation forecasting or monetary policy, in my judgment. No matter what was supposed to happen, during the first half of the 1990s, wage rate growth held to a low and narrow range, and there was no sign of mounting inflation. Ultimately, it was the conventional wisdom itself that gave way. Economists began revising the natural level of unemployment downward. Years later, Gene Sperling told a story of how this controversy played out in the Oval Office. In 1995, President Clinton's top economic advisors, Sperling, Bob Rubin, and Laura Tyson, worried that the president was getting carried away with his hopes for the high-tech boom. So they enlisted Larry Summers to administer a reality check. As I knew from our lively breakfast debates, Larry was a technology skeptic, and he normally weighed in with the president only on international issues, so Clinton would realize this was an unusual event. The economists trooped into the Oval Office, and Summers did a short presentation on why tightness in the labor market meant growth would have to slow. Then the others chimed in. Clinton listened for a while, then finally interrupted. "You're wrong," he said. "I understand the theory, but with the Internet, with technology, I can feel the change. I can see growth everywhere." The fact was, Clinton wasn't relying solely on instinct. He'd been out talking to CEOs and entrepreneurs, as he always did. Politicians never want to believe that there are limits to growth, of course, but at that moment, the president probably had a better hands-on feel for the economy than his economists. Both the economy and the stock market continued to boom. Output, as measured by GDP, grew at a super-hot rate of over 6% in the spring of 1996, calling into question another chunk of conventional wisdom, namely that 2.5% was the maximum growth the U.S. economy could healthily sustain. We were doing a lot of rethinking at the Fed. It's easy to forget the speed with which innovations like the Internet and email went from exotic to ubiquitous. Something extraordinary was happening, and the challenge in trying to figure it out as it was happening in real time was considerable. By the time I convened the FOMC on September 24, 1996, 8 months and 7 meetings had passed since we'd last lowered the interest rate. Many committee members were now leaning the other way, toward an increase, so as to preempt inflation. They wanted to take away the punch bowl again. Corporate profits were very strong. Unemployment had dropped to well under 5.5%, and one big factor had changed. Wages were finally rising. Under boom conditions like these, inflation was the obvious risk. If companies were having to pay more to keep or attract workers, they might soon pass along that added cost by raising prices. The textbook strategy would be to tighten rates, thereby slowing economic growth and nipping inflation in the bud. But what if this wasn't a normal business cycle? What if the technology revolution had, temporarily at least, increased the economy's ability to expand? If that was the case, raising interest rates would be a mistake. I was always wary of inflation, of course, yet I felt certain that the risk was much lower than many of my colleagues thought. This time, it wasn't a case of upsetting conventional wisdom. I didn't think the textbooks were wrong. I thought our numbers were. I'd zeroed in on what I believed to be the primary riddle of the technology boom, a question of productivity. The data we were getting from the Commerce and Labor departments showed that productivity, measured as output per hour worked, was virtually flat in spite of the long-running trend toward computerization. I could not imagine how that could be. Year in and year out, business had been pouring vast amounts of money into desktop computers, servers, networks, software, and other high-tech gear. I had worked with a sufficient number of plant managers on capital investment projects over the years to know how such purchasing decisions were made. They would order expensive equipment only if they believed the investment would expand their production capacity or enable their employees to produce more per hour. If the equipment failed to do at least one of these, the managers would stop buying. Yet they'd kept pumping money into high tech. This became evident as early as 1993, when new orders for high-tech capital began to accelerate after a protracted period of sluggish growth. The surge continued into 1994, suggesting that the early profit experience with the new equipment had been positive. There were other, even more persuasive indications that the official productivity figures were awry. Most companies were reporting rising operating profit margins, yet few had raised prices. That meant that their costs per unit of output were contained or even falling. Most consolidated costs, that is, for business considered as a whole, are labor costs. So if labor costs per unit of output were flat or declining, and the rate of growth of average hourly labor compensation was rising, it was an arithmetical certainty that if these data were accurate, the growth of output per hour must be on the rise. Productivity was truly accelerating. And if so, then rising inflation would be unlikely. Even though I was sure my analysis was right, I knew better than to try to convince my colleagues on the basis of back-of-the-envelope figuring. I needed something more persuasive. With a few weeks to go before the September 24, 1996 meeting, I asked the Fed staff to pull apart the federal productivity statistics and study the underlying data, industry by industry, for dozens of industries. I had been bothered by an apparent discrepancy between the Bureau of Labor Statistics data on output per hour for all non-farm industries and a separate estimate for corporations. Matching the two implied that there was no productivity growth in non-corporate America, an unlikely conclusion. When I asked for the detailed industry breakdown, typically the staff would joke that the chairman wanted embellishments and enhancements. This time, they said it was more like I was asking them to undertake the Manhattan Project. Nevertheless, they burrowed into the data and rendered their report just in time for the FOMC meeting. On that Tuesday, opinion in the committee was divided. Half a dozen members wanted to raise rates right away. As Tom Meltzer, the hawkish president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, put it, to take out an insurance policy against inflation. Others were on the fence. Alice Rivlin, who was now in her third month as vice chairman of the Board of Governors, sized up the situation in her usual droll manner. The worried faces around this table, I think we should remind ourselves, are worrying about the best set of problems we could think of having. Central bankers all around the world would wish for this set of statistics. While she agreed that we were in an inflationary danger zone, she also pointed out that we have not seen higher inflation yet. When it was my turn to speak, I came on strong, using the staff's report. It seemed that the government had been underestimating productivity growth for years. It had not, for example, found any efficiency gains in the service economy. In fact, the government's calculations made it appear that productivity there was shrinking. Every committee member knew that was absurd on its face,